I think our children are our future. I know they are.
Yeah.
You know, they are our future world leaders, doctors, teachers, anything.
Welcome to Made Us. I am your host, Zach Weaver. Joining me this week is Jalee Busby. Jalee and I had a great conversation about restoring hope and her passion for rehabilitating juveniles. I will tell you guys, I was surprised that this conversation got pretty emotional for both of us, and I really had a wonderful time sitting and talking with her about this topic. And as with every week, if you enjoy what you're hearing on Made Us, go on to Apple Podcasts, leave us a 5-star rate and review, and make sure to hit that subscribe button. And if you don't listen to Apple Podcasts, subscribe in whatever your favorite podcast app is. And with all that being said, don't forget to share it with a friend. Sharing the show with a friend really helps these stories grow and helps get these stories out there. And of course, between each episode, you can keep up with us on social media at facebook.com/madeuspodcast or on Instagram and Twitter at madeuspodcast. And if you have a guest suggestion, feel free to drop us a line at madeuspodcast@hotmail.com. And I know I've said it before, but I truly appreciate everybody's support and feedback. And I want to take time to read another review for you guys. This one comes from Crazy Dog Lady Lele. It's a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It says, love it. Loving the podcast. It's such a nice break to remind yourself that everybody has been through something. Love the inspirational stories the guests have to tell, and closing the show with the words of the wise. So thank you again, Crazy Dog Lady Lele. So I really hope you guys enjoy today's episode. Once Jalee opens up in this episode, you can really hear the passion in her voice and how much restoring hope to these juveniles really means to her. And during the interview, you hear an interesting story of how we actually know each other. So with all that being said, please enjoy this conversation with Jalee Busby. Jalee, welcome.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. I'm glad you joined me today.
Thank you for having me.
How was your day?
It's good. It's productive. How's your day?
It was a long day.
Mine too.
Not feeling the greatest. I've had a bunch of cough syrup, so I'm getting ready to start my mumble rap career.
And I think I'm getting sick too. But
oh, good.
We'll work through it.
Real good.
Yeah.
So let's tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Okay. So I am a graduate of Western Michigan University. I graduated with a major in criminal justice and sociology. And when I graduated, I worked at Star Albion Prep, which is like an alternative juvenile residential facility.
Okay. What'd you do there?
Well, I started as a long-term substitute teacher. They were in the process of being bought by a new like service, kind of a new ownership.
Okay.
So they kind of scrapped everything and started over. So they scrapped all their teachers and they only had like, I think, 3 certified teachers to start and everybody else was a sub. And I was fresh out of college looking for something to do in my career field. And it was, you know, I thought it was easy. So I started there. It's not easy. and then from there, I got promoted to a case manager, which is totally different than being a teacher.
Okay. You say you were a teacher there. What does that entail?
Well, you know, a normal public school, it's a lot different than a residential facility. There, I mean, I had all the responsibilities of a teacher. They gave me a lot of freedom in that aspect, which I really appreciated. So I can kind of make my classroom how I wanted it. And I started working with the juvenile boys first, and then I got moved to the girls. I had a lot of freedom to kind of like make my room what it was. So I'm all about kind of like, you know, being passionate and working hard. And especially with that demographic of youth, that's exactly what they need.
Yeah.
They need more attention and more kind of individualized focus rather than like a public school.
Okay.
It was a lot harder than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
There's a lot of trials and problems that nobody realizes and you can't expect until you're thrown in that situation.
Oh, I can imagine. As far as that goes, was there like subjects you taught or what were you teaching? I don't know.
Okay. So I taught math. That was my class. So just like a public school, at the residential facility I worked at, they were anywhere between ages 12 through 18.
Okay.
But like scholastically, they were like grades probably 9th through 12th. So they did online schooling. So my job as like a teacher of online schooling was to monitor, make sure they're doing their online schooling correctly, answer questions if they had questions, and kind of break it up. Like we played games and I gave lesson plans and gave like, you know, worksheets and stuff like that. So I taught math, and it was really hard because, you know, like a public school, one classroom is one grade. But for my personal, like when I was teaching, I had 5 different hours of classrooms that were all math, but they were all different grades mixed in one class. So I could have one class of like 9th and 12th graders.
Okay.
And they were all in different math. Like some was in algebra, some was in like geometry, some were in any, you know, anything in between, financial math, anything. So that was really hard trying to teach one classroom when you have kids of like 4 or 5 different subjects.
I can imagine. That's definitely difficult. It's definitely more of just trying to give those kids guidance.
Yeah. That's exactly what it was, trying to give them guidance, trying to make sure they're self-sufficient, because a lot of these kids aren't self-sufficient, and that's why they end up where they do, or they think they're self-sufficient, but it's not a productive type of self-sufficiency, so that's how they end up where they end up.
Yeah, so I'm going to take you back for a second. You said this was like a residential center, so it's almost like a juvenile center more than a school, or kind of, I mean, I know you're kind of referring to it more as a school, but I'm just trying to get a grasp of what it actually is.
Okay, so no, it wasn't a juvie, but it was the same idea. So it essentially looked like a college campus. It was kind of in the middle of nowhere, and there were they called each of their homes cottages. In each cottage were anywhere up to 14 youth. There was 3 girls' cottages and I think 8 boys' cottages, and they were all broken up kind of by like a fence.
Okay.
So there was an SRY cottage. Well, there was 3 SRY cottages, which are sexually reactive youth cottages.
What does that mean?
It means any type of sex-related crime, whether it's CSC or anything like that.
Okay.
In one, and they were broken up by ages. And then there was juvenile justice or JJ cottages, which were just your basic like aggression, theft, you know, any type of crime you can think of, essentially.
Okay.
And then there were 3 substance abuse cottages, which is just drug offenses. And then in the 3 girls' cottages, there were 2 JJ girls' cottages and an abuse and neglect cottage. The abuse and neglect, they don't necessarily have to have an offense, just don't really have a place to go.
Okay.
So that's why.
That's almost like a safe shelter type.
Kind of. I mean, most of them have some kind of offense.
Okay.
But so that's where they were. The boys didn't have an abuse and neglect cottage, but the girls do. Actually, I think they do now, because as I left, they were building one.
So. Okay. So how did you get into that? I mean, I know you said you went to that straight after college. Where did that, I mean, how did that get approached to you?
So my junior year of college, I took a correctional process class, and my teacher, who I love her to death, I studied abroad with her.
Hold on. Where'd you go?
I went to the Netherlands.
You went to the Netherlands?
Yes, I did.
Nice. What'd you go there for?
Do you want me to backtrack?
Yeah, absolutely.
My senior year of college, I took my advanced criminology class, which is my capstone class that you have to take to graduate.
Okay.
And I'd been wanting to study abroad for a long time, but I couldn't find a program that, for one, was for criminal justice, because there's hardly any opportunities for anything criminal justice related, and one that fit my schedule and fit like where I wanted to go and for how long. So actually, the end of my junior year, my teacher presented this idea. She's like, it's kind of just an idea right now, but we want to take anywhere from 8 to 11 criminal justice students to Amsterdam for a week during spring break. And the whole class was like a comparative justice class. So the idea was we would pick kind of a topic related to criminal justice and Dutch law.
Okay.
And research it. And that was the whole class. And then when we get to the Netherlands, we went to Utrecht University, and we spent a week there with different professors and different students. And like we toured the jail, and we toured the International Criminal Court, which is in The Hague.
Okay.
And we just did a lot of different things, and it was all about pushing our research.
So you said when you picked a law in Dutch law?
No,
so
we picked like a social problem.
A social problem.
So like my social problem was police brutality, but because it was comparative justice, my topic was police brutality among minorities in the Netherlands and how that differs between us and the States.
Okay.
And how it differs over there, because they are they're very, very low crime country. They're a very neutral country, and their laws are a lot different. So like that was my topic. I wanted to know the differences and if there was any similarities or differences.
That's interesting. And what did you find? I mean, when you went there, how did that pan out for you?
Well, I found that over here, our minorities are kind of, in a very umbrella term, are black people. When we think of police brutality, minorities, that's, I think, the first thing that comes to mind.
Yeah.
Over there, what I found throughout my research is a lot of like the African island countries and those, and like Moroccans, those are kind of the minorities. They don't call them black people over there, they have their own term for it. They're called Alachtanin or something like that. But those are still considered minorities. So it's fascinating that even, you know, in Europe, their minorities still kind of resemble the minorities that we have.
Yeah.
And they are subjected to a lot of the same issues that minorities in America have. Like, you know, just I think a couple months before we went to Amsterdam, there was a headline in the Dutch news about an Aruban guy who got killed by a Dutch police officer. So like that was just fascinating to me because you don't hear about it.
Yeah.
But internationally, it's still a problem that, you know, we think that it's only a problem here and we're kind of closed-minded to it, but it's not. It's a problem that happens all over the place. It just might look a little different.
No, absolutely. That makes sense. So for the listeners, you are biracial.
Mm-hmm.
And is that something you noticed growing up a little bit? Or, I mean, did you have any feelings toward that?
I guess that's a good question. I never felt like...
I know this about you, that you're biracial, come from a biracial family, but you grew up in a predominantly white city.
Yes. So I never felt the negative aspect about it. I guess the problems I faced were kind of positively, but it didn't feel that way. Like in the sense of I was never really like bullied or picked on because I was a minority, but just little kind of stuff like, oh, you talk really white.
Yeah.
Or I want to touch your curly hair. Or, you know, you're the only black girl on the cheer team. You're a cheerleader. Why aren't you? Or, you know, you're black. Why aren't you running track? Why aren't you playing basketball? You know, like you're the only black girl on a cheer team. Like, that's crazy. And then especially when I went to college, it was the same thing. Like even being in college and being in a big city with a lot of people, kind of the same thing. I would still be the only black person in my classroom. So I was never like, I never felt the negative side of it because I think of how I was raised and where I was raised. And the way that I talk, but I guess it's not really a positive. Like, I never felt like proud of being diverse. I think I always tried to blend in by the way I dressed and by the way I did my hair and the way I talked, just because I got so much attention from sticking out as it was. I tried not to stick out as much anymore. And that might sound dramatic, but living in St. Joe, that's kind of realistic. I graduated with 4 black girls in my graduating class.
Yeah. You being one of them.
So maybe
3 other ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine that's, you know, I can't imagine as a white male, a white middle-aged male, like that doesn't make any, you know, I can't even fathom what that would be. But I could definitely see that, you know, as you said, you're just trying to kind of blend in and be.
Mm-hmm. I didn't want any more attention than I already got. Like I knew being, and like I said, it sounds dramatic, but I knew being in a classroom, being the only black person in the classroom, I got enough attention as it was, and not verbal attention, not really physical attention, just kind of subconscious attention.
Yeah.
You know, people had to watch what they say or watch what they did or, you know, watch the, you know, things like that, the topics they talked about. And, you know, being the only black person on a cheer team, you know, I got enough attention as that was. So I didn't want to dress a certain way or especially talk a certain way or listen to a certain type of music or watch a certain type of show on TV or just anything like that because I didn't want any more focused on me. I don't like being the center of attention as it is.
Yeah.
So I didn't want, you know, any more attention.
No, that makes sense. So do you think any of that kind of led you to this criminal justice? Or I mean,
I think so. I think it didn't at first. Like, that's not why I got interested in it. But the more I studied it and researched, and especially now working with minority youth, that's all I care about. And that's all I envision. And I never thought about it before because, like I said, growing up in St. Joe, I never thought about my race or how I look just because I spent so much time trying to blend in.
Yeah.
There got a point in time when I just did it subconsciously. I just did it in my sleep. Like I put on certain clothes and went to school. So I knew that that wasn't the focus anymore. But, you know, now like I realize working with youth, like it's a lot of pressure being a minority, and especially a minority who's gotten in trouble or a minority who just talks a certain way.
So you said that that's not necessarily why you got into criminal justice. Mm-hmm. What kind of led you that route? I mean, it just something you liked or something you kind of just fell into?
So honestly, when I was young, I don't remember how old I was, but one of my mom's best friends got murdered. And since then, it seemed like right after that happened, my mom was always watching like crime shows. Like I grew up and was all that was in the background was like Investigation Discovery and the First 48 and whatever. And that really fascinated me. Like I just always had from being really, really young. Like, yeah. I remember being really young and reading her Anne Rule crime books, and I had no business reading yeah. those.
I'll stop you for a second. It was 2002
okay.
when the murder happened. Lisa Fine was the victim. And the reason I know this so well, and we haven't talked about it yet, is your mother is also my mother.
Yeah.
And we are siblings, which kind of blows a lot of people out of the water that they don't realize we're siblings. So that's why I know for a fact that it was 2002, and I know that it was our mother's best friend, or one of our mother's best friends, that got murdered.
Mm-hmm.
So go ahead.
It seemed like right after that happened, she was kind of just, I don't know if it kind of gave her a sense of closure or it kind of opened her up to being more fascinated. I don't know, or if maybe I was just reaching an age where I paid attention more.
Yeah.
But she was just always watching crime shows and stuff. And I was always fascinated about it, but I kind of like put it on the back burner. And then my...
That was a crazy case, too. Do you know anything about that case?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That was her... Essentially, it wasn't her ex-husband because they weren't married, but it was essentially her ex that
they
had...
I thought they were married.
No, they were never married. Oh. It was essentially her ex had broken into her house and assaulted her.
I thought her son... Didn't her son let him in the house?
No, the...
Oh, no. No, you're right. Continue. I'm yeah. sorry. I stopped interrupting.
So her ex broke into her house and was attacking her. He had a snowmobile helmet on, motorcycle helmet on, so that no one could see who it was. And her child and her stepchild were at the house. And this is a man she has a child with. They snuck out their window and ran to the neighbor's house and told the neighbors that, like, their mother was being attacked. And the neighbors called the police, and that was how that kind of went down. And they didn't find her. He actually had killed her and drug her out back and buried her in the backyard. And it was, for our area, being a small area, it was a big deal at the time. And like you said, I mean, they did, well, I don't know if you said that or not, but I read into that they did do a ID channel thing, a story about it.
Yeah, I think it's called like Buried Alive or something. It's buried in the backyard, something like that. I don't know. It's gruesome.
It is gruesome. Whatever the name of it was really gruesome. Mm-hmm. All right, go ahead. Sorry.
So, like I said, I just kind of put my interest about that on the back burner because I wanted to be a doctor growing up. I didn't care. I wanted to be an obstetrician, so I didn't care about anything. And then I got to high school and realized I would probably not become a doctor ever in my life. I wish I could have. If I would have taken school more seriously, I probably could have. So I didn't know what I wanted to do, like where I wanted to go to college, what I wanted to do. And then the end of my junior year, my school counselor mentioned something about taking a criminal justice class at a college campus. About a half hour away from me, there would be kids from all different schools in the area in that class. It would be worth your school credit. It would be fun. It would take up 3 hours of your high school day. You should do it.
Bam.
And I was like, bet, absolutely. Like, yeah. I can meet cute boys. I could take away from my school time. That's exactly my thought process, 100%.
As a junior in high school, that's probably it, too.
Exactly. That's all I cared about. I was like, I don't have to go to school, half the day. I can meet new people. Sure. I don't care. And I took that class, and Rich Albers was my teacher. Okay. Shout out to Rich Albers. I love him. He changed my life. He was the one he was my criminal justice teacher, and he just, opened my eyes to things that I would never realize. I never realized how many aspects there were in criminal justice. I thought, I would tell everybody I'm taking a criminal justice class or majoring in criminal justice, and they were like, oh, you want to be a cop? Absolutely not. That's, nothing against it. That's just not for me. I didn't realize all these different aspects. And because of him, I majored in criminal justice in college, and the rest is history.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I actually wanted to do criminal justice for a while.
Yeah, you should have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I like what I'm doing now.
Yeah, you're okay.
Oh, boy. So when you're in college and you start going forward, did you decide to go straight to criminal justice, or did you have a different major in mind?
No, I went straight to criminal justice because I was excited to go to college. I was on the cheer team before I was even at college. I was excited. I picked a major because I knew I was kind of interested in it.
Yeah.
And I thought, if worst comes to worst, I can always change it. Because I thought, for a minute, I thought I was going to change it to psychology just because that's kind of what everybody does. It's fascinating when you take an intro to psych class. That's what everybody wants. So I thought for a minute that's what I might have changed it to, but it's always been criminal justice from the get-go. And then when I was a junior, I double majored in sociology too.
Did you have a particular niche of criminal justice you wanted to go for, or was it just whatever you fell into?
I didn't until my sophomore year of college. I liked criminal justice a lot. I didn't know what I wanted to do freshman year, And then sophomore year, I took a juvenile justice class. And in my juvenile justice class, we toured a juvie in Grand Rapids.
Okay.
And that was like the light bulb that switched in my mind, because I'd never been to a juvie before.
Yeah.
I'd been to jails plenty of time, but I'd never been to a juvie. And walking through those hallways and seeing those little kids in, you know, the matching, not jumpsuits, but they're like sweatsuits. And in that particular juvie, they were sleeping in the cells with the bars. And it was just heartbreaking. Like, it made me sick.
Yeah.
I did not think a juvie looked like that. And I was like, you know, absolutely not. This is not what I believe personally, what the children, the troubled at-risk youth of America or of anywhere should be in, you know?
Yeah.
There's no reason why, there's no logical reason why that kid ended up there. There's a million reasons behind the scenes of how that kid ended up there. So we should not punish him like that in a jail cell. He's a little kid, you know?
Yeah.
So
your idea for these juveniles is more rehabilitation.
Yeah.
What do you think the path is for these kids like that?
That's a super hard question, because honestly,
well, every case is different.
And honestly, I don't know. Because every kid is different, there's no one size fits all. And that's for adults too.
Yeah.
But especially for kids, I don't know. Because most of the problem why these kids end up where they are is their home life and their backstory. And that's not what we pay attention to. We pay attention to what this kid did and where he's at. And then we try and change him or her in the system, whether it's juvie or residential facility or whatever it is. We try and fix him. We implement all these programs, take him to therapy, do all these things, and then we send him right back to where he came from and expect things to be different. And that's the problem. And unfortunately, I don't know what that change looks like. I think that change looks like starting with the family, figuring out what's wrong with the family, what's wrong with their home life, their environment, and why they are ending up like that. Because especially working with youth, at-risk youth,
yeah,
I have yet to see one kid who comes from or came from a healthy two-parent household that was above the poverty line, that was supportive, like mentally, physically, medically, educationally supportive, that was happy, that wasn't exposing the kids to drugs and to violence and anything else, and didn't have a family member, a parent, a sibling incarcerated. I have yet to see none of those boxes checked on one of the kids that have ended up in the system. Now, that's not to say that that doesn't exist, because some kids are boneheads and make awful decisions.
It does happen.
That absolutely happens. But if you take a poll of a residential facility or a juvie, that percentage is probably 3%.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. It's awesome to see the passion you have in this, too.
Yeah.
When did that realization of that passion hit you?
Well, okay, this kind of answers how I ended up at Star. So it started, like I said, sophomore year when we visited the juvie. I was fascinated because my teacher was also talking about how there was a case right around that time, I don't remember his name, of the youngest kid ever convicted of murder in Michigan. I think he was like 9 years old.
Holy cow.
I don't know when this happened. He like stabbed a kid on the schoolyard. And he was a little black kid and stabbed a white boy. So that was automatically a problem. And my first thought process was, what on earth, you know, was he playing? Did he know right from wrong? Was it an accident? Had he seen it before? You know, there's so many questions. No 9-year-old just does that. There's some reason. I don't genuinely believe he was maliciously, I want this kid dead.
Yeah.
And if he did think that, I believe that there's a reason for that. He had heard that. It had been embedded in him. Somebody he looked up to felt that way, you know. So that's kind of, I was like, you know, what on earth? And I think our children are our future. I know they are.
Yeah.
You know, they are our future world leaders, doctors, teachers, anything. We, you know, adults aren't as malleable as kids are. So we can change kids. So that should be our focus. So that kind of started it. And then my junior year, I had a teacher, Dr. Snyder. I love her. She, I was taking a correctional process class with her. And as part of our class, we had to do a service learning project where we had to pick a facility in Kalamazoo, a criminal justice-related facility. It could have been the juvie. It could have been an alternative high school. There's a couple alternative high schools in Kalamazoo or anything like that. And we had to do 20 hours of community service, essentially. It was just volunteer our time.
Okay.
So I started volunteering at Lakeside Academy, which is actually Star Albion Prep's like sister school. They're owned by the same Sequel Youth Services as their like umbrella owner.
Okay.
So I started at Lakeside. I started as just kind of like a mentor. So I was paired up with this young boy. He told me a little bit about his story, about where he's from, and from the little bit of time we spent together, I can gather, you know, he's had a rough life.
Yeah.
So I kind of just like tutored him around school. I spent maybe like a month or two with him, and I really liked the facility. I liked because it was a residential facility for youth, but it wasn't a juvie. It was the first alternative to juvie I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It was a school, but they had basketball courts and they got to go to events. Like, they got to go, like, they went to a Pistons game one time. They go to, like, Western Michigan football games sometimes. Okay. They get to do certain things. I mean, they have to earn them, but it's not a juvie. You know, if they do well, if they do good things, then they get rewarded, which I believe is, you know, as a kid, that's how you teach kids good, you know, right from wrong.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I don't know that I have ever, up until you told me about, I don't know that I've ever heard of a alternative like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of them, which I had never really heard either until that. But I went, I liked it, and I met the principal. The principal really liked me, and he offered me a substitute teaching job, just a very, you know, on-call, random, like, when we need you, you know, just like normal sub.
Yeah.
So I subbed there on and off for about a year, probably maybe like 15 times.
And this is while you were in school?
While I was in school, yeah. You okay. only needed 90 credits, I think, to be a sub. So I was like, oh, sure, you know, you get paid by the day. Great. Like, it's easy money. It's, you know, a little foot in the door. Why not? Sure. Yeah. And I really, really liked it. And then the principal there was also the principal at Star Albion Prep. And as soon as I graduated, he emailed me and he was like, you know, we started over with our teachers. We need new teachers. We want you to be a long-term, like a full-time sub until we get new teachers.
Nice.
Like, you know, certified teachers. And I was like, okay, great. Like, I'm in. This is exactly what I want to do. This is where I want to be. Everything is great. And that's how I ended up there.
Nice.
Yeah.
That still didn't tell us about your passion.
Oh, I don't know where that stems from. I mean, I like it stems from seeing it firsthand, that yeah. I don't have experience from it. Nobody in my family has ever really like kind of pushed for it. I don't think maybe like advocated for it. Like, I'd never seen any type of interest like coming from my environment, like my home life, my family. Like, nobody really had been in trouble like as a kid in my family or my friends. No, like, none of my friends ever went to juvie. So like, I didn't know where it stemmed from until I saw it firsthand. Like,
yeah.
I saw physically little kids in a jail cell, and I saw little kids being called criminals and thugs and this, that, and the other with, you know, nobody else knowing
yeah.
why. And that's what really got me passionate about it.
Yeah. I can see how that can really flip a switch in you and change that. You know, I can remember when I wanted to do criminal justice and I was taking criminal justice classes. We went to a prison. We went to the Michigan City Prison, which is a maximum security federal prison. It's a big time deal. They have an electric chair there. I mean, they have it all, lethal injection. That's a big time facility. And I remember walking, when we got to go down there, and walking down the range, and you see the living environment that these men, because this was a male facility, mm-hmm. that these men had to live in. And like you said, even though these are men, they're still being treated like animals. And it's just,
yeah,
it's really disheartening. Granted, in that situation, some of those men probably deserve to be treated that way.
Yeah.
But as an overall mass, you know, they have people in prison that are in there for something very minute, that are, you know, basically sharing a cell or next to somebody that's a mass murderer.
Right.
It's really hard to see how that these people can be rehabilitated when they're in an environment like that.
Right. And even still, you know, even those adults who have committed very heinous crimes, you know, where do they come from? That's always my question. And I've always been told, you know, from people very close to me and from people I work with, like, you know, you are looking at it, you know, the glass half full, you're being too optimistic, you're being too naive. But after doing my research and actually working in the field, that's always what I go back to, you know, like, where did they come from? And I'm well aware, I'm the first person to admit, not everybody is like that. There's people who wake up one day and decide to do something.
Yeah.
But that's always my question, is where did they come from? Because nobody focuses on that. And then once you see, like, how do you expect anything other than crime, especially for a little kid? If you're exposed to that, how do you expect a little kid to grow up and be a functioning member of society?
Yeah.
You don't.
And I think it's very important to understand that you don't have to be a product of your environment. We are siblings. I said this already, but we are, what, 12 years difference? So I think it's important to understand that you don't have to become a product of your environment. Now, we're siblings. I said this before, but you're quite a bit younger than me. You're 11 years younger than I am. At the time when I was younger, our mom was really going through a lot. And I saw a lot of things that I shouldn't have had to see. I experienced a lot of things that I shouldn't have had to experience. And it would be very easy for me to blame a lot on that. Not to put this on your plate, but it would be really easy for me to blame a lot, or not to blame, but to be able to put excuses onto that. And I think it's extremely important for people to not necessarily always blame their environment. It's a very easy way out. Now, I know these kids are having situations where their environment is not helping them, but I think that's a big thing, is just trying to help kids understand that they can outgrow and surpass whatever environment they're in.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's the hardest part, is making them realize that. Because, and that goes back to the problem of, we, you know, fix these kids. Like, we have kids, you know, especially at the placement I worked at, they had to spend a certain amount of time there. They had to complete their program, is what we called it. So they had to be successful in their therapy and, you know, be helpful and just, you know, do all these different things to complete their program. Once they completed it, they went back home. You know, how do you tell a teenage kid, you know, who's hanging out with his friends, like, oh no, I completed my program, I'm not going to get involved in that anymore. Like, you know, and what kid is going to say that? So, you know, we want to make these kids believe they're not a product of their environment, but we send them back to these harmful environments when these kids aren't old enough to live on their own. They're not old enough to make their own important decisions. And that's the biggest, like, double-edged sword, I think.
I think a lot of it for me is, and I'm definitely not disagreeing with you, I don't want you to feel like that. I think a lot for me is trying to make sure that we show these kids that you can break away from that. Even though you're getting sent back to that, isn't so much that, yeah, it's hard for these kids to understand that that's, everything's not okay, but it's also more important to make these kids understand that they have the ability to make their own choices, regardless of if they think they do or not.
Yeah, I agree. It's hard because a lot of these kids don't have role models. And as a kid, I mean, I can think of, you know, three right offhand. Those are people I idolize, and they're very, very successful. But if you, you know, don't have a positive role model, if you have a negative role model in your life, and you're still going to idolize that person regardless, especially as a young kid. And when we send them back to these environments, those are the kind of people they're surrounded with. And, you know, it's hard, I think, as a kid, if you break out, if you are strong enough, you know, to say, I'm not going to be like this. I'm not going to be like my parents, like my dad, like my brothers, like my family, my friends.
Yeah.
I'm going to be my own person. Where is he going to go? He's not going to be like that. Where is he going to live? Where is he going to go to schools to where he's, you know, successful? Who is he going to hang out with? Where is he going to work? You know, those are the kind of questions that I definitely believe that should be asked. Because if we don't want them to be like that, you know, where is he going to go if he's not independent?
Yeah.
And that's my biggest thing, because I 100% agree that, you know, these kids are bigger and better than what they are. And you always hear these stories about, you know, like we have a kid from, I think he's from Lakeside, who, well, he's not a kid, he's a grown man now. He was in Lakeside. He was in a facility and he became an NFL player. So he is, you know, a living, breathing example. And during my time at Lakeside, just as a sub, I went to, they had like an assembly, something like that. And he came and spoke, and he was like, you know, I was right here. I lived in this and this dorm. I had this and this teacher. And, you know, look where I am now.
Yeah.
And that's amazing. But, you know, unfortunately, he's an NFL player. He can only come, you know, once a month, once every 2 months to talk to these kids. Yeah. He can't, you know, be in the dorms with them every night. He can't be, you know, this, that, and the other. Yeah, so
that is an incredible positive role model for those kids, though.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, for some kids, it'll work. For some kids, they only need, you know, a little bit of scaredness and they'll succeed. But for some kids, unfortunately, you know, that's not the case.
No. Yeah, it's definitely not.
No. But you're not the first person who's kind of flipped that. And I know that I get like a lot of, you kind of look at this positively.
Yeah.
Like our grandpa.
Yeah.
Is the same way. I think he's very kind of, I don't know, I don't want to say disappointed. That's not the word I want to think of. And this will make me like cry. But like, I think he's very kind of thinks like the work I'm doing is in vain.
Okay.
A little bit.
I don't know that he thinks that.
That's like the first, I don't know, I kind of feel just like I've disappointed him. It'll make me cry if I talk about it, but we can talk about it.
No, I don't think you've disappointed him. And I know what you're saying because...
That's not the right word I want to use, but I don't know. I talk about like my passions with him and he always kind of just like flips it. And that's the first time ever I've been like from him. Like,
yeah. You know. It is a tough subject and I can mildly understand where he would be coming from.
Oh, so can I.
You know, because it's a very easy path. And not that he's a very intelligent person.
He's the smartest person I know.
He truly is. But I think it's an easy path if you don't see it.
Right. And yeah, that's exactly what it is. And I think that's why it's so hard. That's why I'm so passionate about it because I've seen it firsthand.
Yeah.
And I'm so, so unbelievably passionate about it. And for, you know, it's not a very popular field at all because it's extremely hard. And it's extremely, I don't want to say unrewarding because it's very rewarding after the fact, but you know, you don't get a pat on the back for going the extra mile for, you know, a kid who, you know, has screwed up in the past. I've had a lot of personal, you know, people in my life, very important people. My boyfriend even, yeah. You know, has been like, you're very naive, you're very, you know, positive. I don't know if I agree with, you know, the idea of you helping these bad kids. And it's really hard unless you see it firsthand.
I can imagine it's, yeah. It would be very easy to brush off, but once you see something, you know, you can't unsee it.
Right. I think the thing that really, like, what's a good way to say set me off? But, like, we had a kid, and I loved him. He was the nicest kid I've ever met in my entire life. I don't know what he was in there for, and I don't care.
Yeah.
But he was just the most amazing person. And he was supposed to be released, like, 3 different times. During his release day, they took him to court, and nobody showed up to pick him up. And that's what, like, you know, broke my heart because he was the captain of our basketball team.
Yeah.
He was just, like, the most exemplary, perfect student that we could have given the fact he completed his program. He did what he needed to do, and he was so positive. How can you see that and not feel for that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that's the hardest part is, like, getting people to realize. And I get that it's so, so hard. You know, you just want to like shake somebody and be like, how can you not feel bad for this person? You know, how do you not want to help this person?
Yeah, it is weird. And I think parents take a lot of things for granted. You know, I'm talking about maybe this kid's parents or whatever his, you know, his, whatever it may be, people take too many things for granted when it comes to that. And they don't want to, I don't want to show their children respect. But,
oh, I definitely think.
But
in a way,
yeah, they just take too many things for granted and they don't want to help these kids out because they're so they're just trying to be selfish. They're only Absolutely. Worried about themselves. Yeah, I think a lot of it is, you know, the parents being really selfish and just kind of not understanding the need or respect you need to give your children, mm-hmm. especially children of that. I don't want to say nature, but children of that situation. You know, where they're coming out of something that they need at that moment in their life, they need you more than ever.
Yeah. And I think, at least from what I've seen, I think once a kid has really turned his or her life around and they want to go home and they want to be successful, I think the parents realize a lot of it was because of you. You know, yeah. This kid is in there, and I'm not blaming it 100% on parents. That is not the case. However, there are some cases that is the reason.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it, you know, in circumstances I've seen, when a kid succeeds, the parent doesn't want to help because they realize, like, you know, you're going to do better than me. You're going to, you know, make better decisions, and I'm probably the one that hurt you, and I don't want that guilt, and I don't want that responsibility.
Yeah.
And I don't want you to do well, me be embarrassed, or me, you know, look like an idiot because you're doing better than I am.
Yeah.
I think that's a lot of it.
That's incredibly... It's selfish.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
That whole train of thought is just incredibly selfish to mm-hmm. think that way.
Yeah.
Because that's the one person, you know, I wish the best for my kids. I'm not pretending that I'm the greatest parent in the world. That's not my, I know I could be a better parent. I want to be a great parent, but I know I could be a better parent. But just that thought process, I would never put that out there as like, I want my kids to fail so I can be better than them.
And that's what's so frustrating when I think that people kind of don't acknowledge the fact that these aren't bad kids,
yeah.
You know, that they come from stuff like that. That's what's so hard that people don't realize. That, you know, people see it at for what it is on the surface. They don't realize that these parents don't care.
Yeah.
Don't care that they're out until 3-4 in the morning and they're 14 years old because they don't care where they are. You know, they don't care that. And when you break it down and you think of it like that, I think it definitely opens more people's eyes. At least I hope.
Yeah, I hope it does too.
It's a problem.
It is a problem. And I'm really happy to see how passionate you are about this. Yeah. I think that's a huge thing for me. And not only that you're obviously a family member, you're my sister, but I'm happy just to see you as a person that you're passionate about this. It is a topic that more people need to be passionate about, mm-hmm. is helping rehabilitate. I don't want to say just juveniles, but try to give a child every opportunity to succeed.
And that's exactly what part of the problem is. You know, these kids that end up in this facility or any facility, any type of trouble, don't come from equal opportunity. You know, if you're a minority kid who comes from, you know, a single parent household or has a parent incarcerated and you live below the poverty line and you are uneducated because you either run truant or because you just don't have a way to get to school, which is a big problem that, you know, a lot of people don't realize.
Yeah.
A lot of kids don't go to school because they don't have transportation. You know, if you look at those reasons, this kid is set up for failure. They're not coming from equal opportunity, and that's no fault of their own.
Yeah.
That's not their fault that, you know, they have a parent incarcerated, that their parents are divorced, that they don't have money in the house, that they, you know, are the oldest and have to raise their 8 siblings while mom goes to work and dad is in jail. You know, that's not their fault.
Yeah.
And then again, when you look at that, how on earth do we expect them to function?
Yeah.
And there's a lot more kids like that than I think we realize.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's sad to say, but I can definitely imagine mm-hmm. that. So I'm going to ask you the same thing I ask everybody to wrap this up.
Okay.
If you had one piece of advice to give somebody, whether it's becoming passionate about a career, whether it's helping these children, whatever it may be, what would your advice be?
One piece?
could be multiple pieces.
I think I have multiple. I don't know everything. I think my biggest piece, don't let anybody tell you what you care about isn't important. I think I've had a lot of that, and that only makes me more passionate. That only makes me want to prove them wrong. So that's a big thing that I would say. Never let anybody tell you that, you know, it's stupid or it's not going to make a difference, because it will make a difference. And, you know, I think that just always realizing that somebody out there has it worse than you. Like, I lay in bed at night and I pray every night, and I, you know, always pray for people around me, above me, and that have problems. You know, we all have problems, so I pray for my family. But everybody in any circumstance has it worse than you, even at your lowest of lows. And for people to remember that, I think you can be really happy.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
So if anybody's interested in getting a hold of you, is there a way that people can contact you to talk to you about this?
Yes. So my email is juliebusby1@gmail.com. I'll spell it for you.
Yeah, please spell it for us, because we all know, well, growing up with you, I know that no one can get your damn name right.
God forbid. Okay, it's juliebusby1@gmail.com.
We appreciate that. And you're open to people obviously getting hold of you.
I love talking. Any questions? Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. I really appreciate you joining me tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Julie,
I think you need to answer that, because if you're like, oh, this is somebody I know,
yeah.
I call her Jelly Bean.
Yeah.
Who the hell is that?
She probably should have thought of that beforehand.
So probably Julie.
Julie. Okay. You said this was a... You're killing me.
Sorry.